Access to technology. Access to technology has a history which is not as long as some, but it is an important piece. We have two people to present on the access to technology piece. One of them is Dan Goldstein, who is a lawyer that we've worked with for, I think it's 25 years, although it may have been a little less than 25 years. And the other is Megan Sadu. Megan Sadu is an attorney at the Brown, Goldstein, and Levy firm. She focuses on disability rights cases, and she has participated in many of the groundbreaking lawsuits involving access to technology litigated by Brown, Goldstein, and Levy. And she has served as counsel for the National Federation of the Blind. And she's going to begin, but Dan Goldstein is a partner for this law firm, Brown, Goldstein, and Levy. He's been a disability rights lawyer for at least two decades of his service in that law firm, and he learned a lot of what he knows as counsel for the National Federation of the Blind. He's successfully initiated a national legal campaign to ensure access to technology by prevailing in a number of lawsuits, Cardtronics, Target, America Online. I said to Dan a while back that we wanted to get at this technology business because as technology expanded, it was important for us to have access to it. And I said that the expansion of technology properly done could increase our possibilities for understanding and getting at information, but improperly done could be a bar as well as a means of access. And I said, I want people to know that equal access to information is at least as important a right as equal access to facilities. And so this is a task for you. And one of the things we noticed was that although there were rules that said you should build your bank machines so that people could use them, lots of people were building them so that we couldn't use them. There were three manufacturers of bank machines in those days. I do not know how many there are now, but there were three then. Diebold was one of them. We noticed that Diebold had deployed some machines without selling them to somebody else. The usual custom is that you build them and then you sell them to somebody else, and somebody else deploys them, and the person who bought them and deploys them is the one who is doing whatever the commerce is, so you can't get at the manufacturer. The bank said to us, well, if the manufacturer would build them so that we could use them, then we'd have them for you, but they won't. And the manufacturer said, well, if the banks ordered them so that they had accessibility built into them, then of course we'd do that, but the banks won't. They pointed at each other. We found that the manufacturer had deployed some without selling them to the bank first. Great. We'll sue them. So we sued them. The president of the company called me and he said, what'd you sue us for? And I said, well, you know, you got these inaccessible machines out there. He said, well, why didn't you tell me they were inaccessible? I said, they're inaccessible and I've told you with a lawsuit. He said, well, why don't we get together to talk about it? So we did. This was a guy named Wally O'Dell. And he was a macho kind of a character. So when we got together for negotiation, he wanted to demonstrate that he was macho. And of course, I'm a macho kind of a character, so I wanted to show that I was macho. So we got together, and one of the things that I thought we would do is show him how blind people barbecue. So we barbecued, and the barbecuing that we do has, when you do it with certain flair about it, a flame that shoots up out of the grill 6 or 8 feet, and we're doing this and showing off and so forth, and Wally's impressed. We eventually came to an agreement. They would make their machines accessible. They would assist us with development of technology by providing us with $1 million worth of support for our technology work. We were delighted with the agreement. Wally said, if you're going to have this agreement, you got to, one of the things that's a requirement of the agreement is we got to get together and we got to barbecue. All right. We said, we'll do it. And I thought to myself the morning of the barbecue, I thought we're going to have an important agreement tonight and it's going to be dramatic and everything, but barbecuing, Wally's seen this before and it'll just be a me too, same old, same old. It'll be nice, but it won't be new. What can we do to impress Wally? And I thought, I got it. We'll shoot off some firecrackers. Wally's never seen a blind person shoot off firecrackers. As it happened, I had obtained some firecrackers which exceed the limits of firecrackerdom in some arenas. These are M160s. The story is, I don't know whether it's true, that they have the power of about a half a stick of dynamite. I know how to shoot firecrackers. As you see, I have 10 fingers. So I got Wally around there, and I said to him, all right, I'm going to show you how blind people shoot firecrackers. And I lit one off, and it went off with a loud boom. We were out at the Action Fund. Many of you know the place. It has a gate. We shut the gate. I shot one or so, and maybe two, and then I said to Wally, all right, your turn. And he was a little nervous, but he took this big firecracker, and he's trying to light this firecracker. And I know how to light them safely, and he wasn't doing it properly. And Mrs. Jernigan is saying to him, no, not like that. Do it. So anyway, he shot one off. And we're going to shoot some Roman candles and some bottle rockets and things like that. I mean, we just a show. Pretty soon we see this police light going down at the end of the driveway. We throw the firecrackers into the bushes and everybody rushes into the house and we send Dan Goldstein down to the end of the driveway. He's a lawyer after all. Let him take care of the problem. He sent in and he said they want to see the owner. Apparently, we hadn't thought about this, but this is Halloween. And we hadn't noticed that, but the police, when they heard these big loud noises, that they thought people had shotguns and were killing each other. And Dan had told them that we were making a $1 million deal and just celebrating a $1 million deal, and this was going to be very helpful to the disabled of the country. And the cops said, well, the next time you want to do a $1 million deal, please call. With that, I introduce to you Dan Goldstein and Megan Sadu.
Thank you, Dr. Maurer. One of the things I appreciate about this symposium, beyond the entertaining stories Dr. Maurer gets to tell about Dan and other colleagues, is the opportunity to step out of the office outside of day-to-day work that we all do, and think about where our current focus is headed with the disability rights movement. Much of my focus, and many others lately, has been surrounding access to information, and particularly digital books. And so yesterday's David Furlager asked us to reflect on how far we have come in the 20 years since the ADA was enacted, and where we imagine we will be 20 years from now I started to think about this time frame in terms of where we were and where we're headed with books and technology. 20 years ago in 1990, when the ADA was passed, I was 12 years old and not quite aware that the ADA had of the implications of the ADA yet. But at that summer, my family had just purchased our first home computer. It was a DOS, which had very limited functionality compared to what we expect of computers today. Basically a black screen with some text and a C prompt. And when I went to school, I carried a backpack full of heavy print books. My mother, being a children's librarian, had me spend much of my childhood in the public library, where I was surrounded by shelves of print books, reading whatever I could get my hands on from our small town public library offerings. By the time I went to college, I had my own computer and email. The internet had just started to take off, but I received my education primarily through print books assigned by my professors. The 12-year-old of today in 2010 lives in a vastly different world surrounded by technology and mobile access to information at every turn, from the internet to cell phones and iPhones and now iPads, and if not yet, then very soon to books. When the 12-year-old today goes on to college only a few years from now, she will likely not have a print textbook. It will be digital, with interactive tests and study questions customized to her courses, full of multimedia and opportunities to collaborate with her colleagues and classmates. Where she will be 20 years from now and how she will access books and information in the workplace, I can only imagine. A psychology professor, Larry Rosen, has recently dubbed this generation, born in the late 1990s, the I generation. The I, he says, stands for both the technologies these students use, such as the iPod, the iPhone, and the Wii, which has two I's after it, and the individualized ways in which students use these tools. I-geners, he says, are growing up with portable technology. Literally from birth, these children are able to grow up using mobile technology everywhere they turn. Well, I don't know if the I-generation term will stick, but as I thought about it, thought of other ways that the I represents the technology, including the technology in books that this generation will come to expect. And that includes information that's instant, that's individualized, that's interactive. This is a generation on the cusp of the transition from print books to digital books, and many books have already begun to adopt these features. But let's step back to where we are today, and particular to the implications of this transition from print to digital books for the 30 million Americans with print disabilities. What I want to address is, first of all, the current model of access to books for people with print disabilities. It's a model primarily based on separate access that is not equal to what the print experience offers. And then I will talk about the entrance of mainstream digital books, the technical barriers to accessibility of those books, the strategies we've employed, both through litigation and advocacy, to overcome some of those barriers, and finally, the new challenges we face ahead. Access to the printed word has historically been one of the greatest challenges faced by the blind and millions of other Americans with print disabilities, including those with learning disabilities, such as dyslexia, processing issues, developmental delays or intellectual disabilities, and those who cannot access print or manipulate books because of neurological or muscular disorders or upper spinal cord injuries or simply severe arthritis. Because they cannot read print books, this group of people has had to rely upon alternative and inferior avenues to gain access to the printed word. Since until recently, books have predominantly been available only in print, which is inherently inaccessible to people with print disabilities. To read and enjoy the knowledge and information contained in those books, print-disabled community has had few limited options. They can subscribe to alternative library services through Bookshare, the National Library Service, and other such entities. They can purchase commercially available audiobooks, or if a student can rely on the school or university to attempt to obtain a digital file from the publisher or scan and convert a print book into an electronic copy. Each of these alternatives is woefully inadequate when compared to the quality and quantity of print material and information available to non-disabled readers. Libraries for the blind and print disabled offer only a small fraction of the books available to the non-disabled public in formats that are accessible, including electronic formats that work with text-to-speech software or a refreshable braille display, in audio, or in braille. Currently, only 5% of all published works are available in accessible formats. Of that amount, 90% of these accessible formats are produced by and at the cost of the voluntary and nonprofit sector. And to put that disparity in context, the Library of Congress receives some 22,000 items each working day and adds approximately 10,000 items to its collections daily. But its National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, one of the largest library collections of accessible materials, can only produce about 2,000 titles a year, representing less than 1% of books published annually. Most print-disabled people are unable to borrow from these collections at all, however, because of the narrow scope of the Chafee Amendment, which, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the Chafee Amendment, is essentially an exception under the Copyright Act, which permits certain entities to distribute accessible copies of books to people with print disabilities without violating copyright law. To access these few books, print and disabled people must prove their disabilities in accordance with the Chafee Amendment. For many individuals who have dyslexia or processing disorders or other print disabilities, the medical proof required to qualify for access can be costly or difficult, if not impossible, to obtain at all. As a result, these individuals have even fewer opportunities to access the printed word. Commercially available audiobooks are similarly limited, accounting for only 5% of books in print, and often available only in abridged formats, and only long after the issuance of the print book. Finally, students and others who require print books that are not available in audio or through a library service for people with print disabilities and who can prove they are qualified under Chafee often must have the print book ripped apart, scanned, and run through optical character recognition software to create an accessible version of the book, a process that can take hours, even months of time. And the final result often ends up being full of conversion errors, lacking the navigability like chapter headings and page numbers, rendering the book difficult and sometimes even impossible to read. This is the current model of access for books that exist today for people with print disabilities. The model of commercial publishing, however, is rapidly transitioning from a print model to a digital model. While mainstream digital books have been around for some time, in the past 2 years, with the advent of the Kindle and Sony ebook readers and the Google digitization project, there has been a rapid ushering in of commercial ebooks into the marketplace. Ebooks offer everyone portable, instant access to the electronic versions of books, increasingly in all industries, from trade to popular books, professional and niche market books, and educational publishing, such as textbooks in K-12 and higher ed. These mainstream books offer the opportunity for print-disabled readers to have, for the first time in history, equal access to the printed word. Unlike print, electronic books are inherently accessible. As digital information, they can be conveyed visually, orally, or tactilely through a refreshable braille display. The technology to get there is not very complicated. There are four technical components to having access in a mainstream digital book. Number one, the content has to be accessible. That means that the text is rendered in a text format like EPUB or DAISY with the structural data like navigations and headings in place, not merely as an image. Second, the digital rights management has to be accessible. Digital rights management, or DRM, is the encryption and other protection that publishing industry puts onto its books to ensure that they are safe from piracy. Often what happens is, even if you have accessible content, the wrapper of encryption around the content is inaccessible and prevents the screen reader from getting to the content. Third, where you have a dedicated e-book reading device, such as a Kindle or a Nook or a Sony e-book reader, the device itself has to be accessible, meaning it has text-to-speech and all the navigation functions that allow a person who is blind or with a print disability to control the device. And then finally, the application or e-book system itself has to be accessible. And by that I mean, increasingly, digital books are available not only through devices, but on your computer and on your iPhone and on all the mobile platforms that we carry with us day to day. The web browser, the software download, the iPhone or mobile application has to be accessible. Well, while these technical barriers are not significant, we've faced many barriers in the industry itself in terms of getting equal access to books as they transition into digital formats. So I'm going to highlight some of our advocacy and litigation efforts on behalf of the National Federation of the Blind and the Reading Rights Coalition in the past year to tell you a little bit about some of the progress and barriers we've confronted since e-books have begun to explode. Well, the NFB and others worked very hard to convince Amazon to release a Kindle that was accessible. And in February 2009, Amazon appeared to adhere to part of the message, but not all of it. They released a Kindle device that had text-to-speech on it so that the content of the books could be read, but had no independent navigation that was accessible, meaning that if you're a blind person, text-to-speech was available in the content, but you couldn't turn the device on or even turn the text-to-speech function on. Well, there was some disappointment. However, the authors, a little more than some disappointment, but what I was going to say is the Authors Guild suddenly thwarted us off of our path by threatening to turn off text-to-speech from the device, from their books altogether. And so before we could put out the fire of the inaccessible navigation, we first needed to keep the text-to-speech that was on the device. Now, trade book publishers have historically been reluctant entrants to the ebook market. They find ebooks economically unappealing, and they fear that these less expensive books will usurp their more lucrative audiobook market and hardcover markets. So they saw text-to-speech as a threat, first arguing that it infringed upon separate audio rights. And when they realized that that argument had no legal muster whatsoever, they then said, well, they had contracts with their authors to sell only the visual display rights. Their real underlying fear, however, was that text-to-speech would usurp their audiobook market because it would increasingly sound like a human voice and no one would ever want to buy an audiobook ever again. So in the wake of that threat, the NFB and other organizations convened a coalition of what's now 32 organizations that represent people with print disabilities. We went out to the Authors Guild and protested. And we got a petition with thousands of signatures. We engaged in other advocacy efforts and finally got the Authors Guild and the publishers to the table. And after months of hard negotiation, earlier this year, an agreement was released on the White House blog where all parties agreed to keep text-to-speech on for the books where there is no audiobook, which constitutes about 95% of digital books. It was a huge victory. Meanwhile, however, we had to deal with the inaccessible Kindle device. And while we were putting out the text-to-speech fire, Amazon released yet another Kindle device, which was also inaccessible, though it had text-to-speech, and announced that 5 universities would be piloting the use of this device because it was designed for educational use. So when we learned about that, yeah, pretty much. And so we immediately, and we being with the support of the Reading Rights Coalition, and on behalf of the National Federation of the Blind and the American Council of the Blind, we promptly filed complaints against all 5 of the universities that were deploying this device inaccessible to its blind and print disabled students. We filed complaints, a federal court complaint against Arizona State University, and then we filed complaints with the Department of Education and the Department of Justice against the remaining universities. While those complaints were pending, we put pressure on the rest of the higher ed community to take a stand and say that they would not deploy ebook technology that is inaccessible to students. Syracuse University, the University of Wisconsin, and the University of Illinois all signed the pledge and agreed not to deploy such inaccessible technology. In response, under the pressure, Kindle announced that it would release a fully accessible Kindle this summer. And earlier this year, the Department of Justice entered into agreements with 4 of the universities, Case Western, Reed, Pace, and Princeton, all of whom agreed with the Department of Justice that they would not deploy inaccessible ebook technology. These were significant victories, and in the meantime, we also settled our case with the Arizona State University, which also agreed it would not deploy the Kindle after it completed the end of the term. Well, in terms of libraries, many libraries are using inaccessible Adobe Digital Editions, lending to their library patrons books that are inaccessible. And so we wrote to many of the libraries, and including the LA Public Library, which publicly agreed to suspend its use of Adobe Digital Editions. And in the wake of that announcement, Adobe announced that it would be releasing an accessible version of Digital Editions by the end of this calendar year. The impact we've been having has been successful. 2 recent examples are the iPad, which Apple recently announced is an accessible device, and the iBook application, we understand, will be accessible. Meanwhile, Blio has entered the marketplace, and it will be a significant player. It is not a device, but rather an application that will offer a large number of books that will be fully accessible. While we've had a lot of success, the road ahead still poses many challenges. College textbooks are leading the shift to digital. Unlike trade books, textbook publishers have embraced e-textbooks as a solution to lost revenue for the used textbook book market. And meanwhile, students and colleges are attracted to the lower costs e-textbooks offer, particularly in this time of difficult economy and budget crises. Student savings for ebooks can be up to 50% less than the print textbook, while textbook publishers maintain a steady revenue stream. The push toward digital in that industry is going fast and hard. Publishers are planning, as many experts have said, publishers are planning to drop print textbooks altogether, and in 5 or 6 years, we will see entirely digital textbooks in higher education. And these digital textbooks will not be just like the typical textbook students have today. Already, they are being embedded with opportunities to share notes and collaborate with professors and students about the reading, to have interactive content tests that are individualized, study questions, the ability to highlight and take notes, and all sorts of other bells and whistles that completely change the landscape of what a college textbook will be. CourseSmart is leading the effort on digital textbooks in higher ed. Currently, it has about 7,000 e-textbooks that it offers in more than 900 course areas across 100 disciplines. Students can access these books on their iPhones, on their computers. They can access them in the classroom, at home, wherever they happen to be. K through 12 is following higher ed, but at a slower pace. And there, what we see is that school districts, who are also suffering from severe budget crises, want to move to digital books, but they often lack the technical infrastructure to get there. California has announced that it will be transitioning to an all-digital textbook curriculum for its K through 12 throughout the state, but the infrastructure hasn't been there to implement that fully. The Department of Education, however, recently released a draft of its National Educational Technology Plan, through which it plans to push the integration of e-books and other technology in the classroom throughout the nation at a rapid-fire pace. That will no doubt mean that K through 12 moves sooner to digital textbooks that we may otherwise have imagined. The future challenges in ensuring that these books remain accessible or become accessible are many. For one, in the legal area, the ADA offers easy access to go after institutional purchasers, but makes it somewhat more difficult to go after the ebook purveyors themselves. In the technical front, we'll see more multimedia and interactive content. And while the technology is being developed to make those features accessible, they certainly pose additional challenges. There's also a time factor. There's an urgency here because technology is moving so quickly in this area that if we fail, we face the prospect of having to retrofit accessibility into these books years down the road, which is a much, much harder fight to win. But I think the largest barrier or challenge that we face currently is an attitudinal one. And that is that we're still stuck in a paradigm, and by we I mean the industry and education largely, is stuck in this paradigm of looking at the model that exists today in terms of access to books for people with print disabilities. And that model is based on separate, which we know is not equal. We need to change the attitude of the industry to one of inclusion, where we have mainstream access for everyone. And for that, I hope that in 20 years, if iGeneration is the name that sticks for the generation of today, that the most important I stands for inclusion.
I want to start by thanking Luann for the third year of a phenomenal seminar. One of the great pleasures also of these seminars are not only the presentations, but the opportunity to both see old friends and catch up, and also to meet some of the people that I've heard about and admired but never gotten the chance to meet until we're brought together by this seminar. And it's really, I think, creates new alliances, new possibilities as we go forward. Megan's presentation on books was comprehensive. I just want to add two small things. One is this National Education Technology Plan is available on the web in draft form. I've been trying to find what the deadline is for comments, and was unable to do so last night, but it is not robust on the topic of inclusion of people with disabilities. There's 4 or 5 pages on universal design, but when there are references to educational outcomes should be the same without regard to race or economic level, that's the end of that sentence. There's not a mention of disability. And so we need people to be writing the Department of Education with suggestions to amend the plan so that there is a more robust commitment to mainstream access to technology and help get the Department of Education out of this rut of, oh, we've got NIMAS and we've got NIMAC that work not. And we've got DSS offices that spend their days ripping books apart and scanning and OCRing them, and isn't that wonderful? We've got to get them out of that mindset and into the mainstream access mindset. So please take some time to read the plan. Little Malox in advance is a good idea. And then send your comments to the Department of Education. They need to hear our voice. The one other follow-up on what Megan said that I wanted to mention, after Reed and the other schools signed their agreements with the Department of Justice, and we signed our settlement with Arizona State University, I got a call from an organization. You know, there are trade organizations for everything, and this one is a trade organization of college information officers and college technology officers, asking me to come to their annual meeting and participate in a panel with the chief technology officer from Reed and I think Pace on the topic of why is the disability community picking on the colleges and universities. So that's going to be fun. I was thinking that maybe I should, you know, go looking goth or something. But we'll see. So I'm going to cover some of the other areas where the issues of technology are being addressed in the courts, access to technology. I'm going to try to keep it very short because I think this is probably an area that is books, and these are areas where people have lots and lots of questions, and so I want to leave as much time for questions as I can. In the area of commercial websites, Target is now old news. It was 2 years ago. We need to go into the First Circuit and bring a lawsuit against a commercial website. The First Circuit is a place where places of public accommodation do not need to be physical places of public accommodation, according to First Circuit case law. And we can do an internet challenge there and hopefully take it up. There's a conflict of circuits if we get this clearly established. And that might be quicker than the regulatory process that Tom mentioned yesterday. And if we can get the ADA to clearly cover commercial websites, I think that will move things forward more quickly. Frankly, I think we've been probably treading water since the Target decision in terms of the amount, the portion of the internet that is accessible. Part of the problem is that Target was very effective, so when you now call a company and say, "Hi, I'm calling from the NFB and your website sucks," they say, "Oh, don't sue, let's talk. And so we're talking with lots of folks. I think between now and July you're gonna hear some announcements about some significant websites becoming accessible, but we can't do this one site at a time. There are simply too many websites for us to go after that are inaccessible. We've got some legal tools, as we demonstrated in Target. We've got the Unruh Act in California. We've got the Disabled Persons Act in California that in some respects would be continue to be better than Title III if we can get a ruling that the ADA applies, simply because of the damage provisions that are in UNRU and DPA. And there is, so far untested, but a wonderful law that we should all think about using as often as we can, which is the Massachusetts Equal Rights Amendment, which reads like 504 without the federal funding. That is, it says that all programs or activities conducted within the Commonwealth may not discriminate on the basis of disability, and it mentions all the other ways you shouldn't discriminate. But that's extraordinary language. That goes far beyond any public accommodation statute. And it hasn't been much used, but it's certainly something we want to do. And as with litigating UNRU and DPA cases in the Northern District of California, Massachusetts is not a too bad a place in terms of the judges either. One significant drawback to Title III in this area that where UNRU offers some promise is that even if Title III applies to the internet, as Tom said yesterday, and as I say every chance I can get, there's no aider and abettor liability. And the way things typically work is you are Goodyear tires, and you go to a website designer, and you say to the website designer, we want a new website for Goodyear tires. I just picked Goodyear tires at random because I need to buy new tires. And the designer comes back with a proposal, and it's got some optional items, one of which is accessibility, and there's a dollar value associated with that optional item. And so not surprisingly, the procurement officer, wanting a promotion and wanting to look good and wanting to earn a bonus, crosses out that option. On the other hand, UNRU says whoever incites, aids, or abets a business enterprise in discrimination is liable. Think about what happens if the website designer is faced with the possibility of coughing up $6 million like Target had to cough up, plus attorney's fees of another $2 million. That may take that out of the optional category. And it may be then when website operators or owners go to website designers, they are faced with a contract that requires accessibility. And so this is an avenue. Stay tuned. I think we've got some ideas of where we can go with this in the coming year, but it could be an accelerator. It's not going to do it by itself, but it can be an accelerator. Another major area of challenge that has not been taken up, and this is going to make those chief information officers and technology officers at the colleges and universities unhappy when I talk about it, but according to WebAIM, 97% of the top pages of college and university websites have accessibility barriers. And we're talking about things like missing alt tags and no headings. I mean, we're not talking about sophisticated issues. We're talking about basic issues. And if the top pages are inaccessible, you can imagine what the rest of the college and university web page of their individual web pages are like. We're looking at a situation where some 12 million students took some of their classes online in 2009. That number is expected to double in the next 5 years. And we are looking at both traditional university websites and distance learning university websites offering more and more only through the internet. Our tools here are obvious: Title II, Title III, Section 504. If and when there's somebody home with the Department of Education, they could play a role in this, a significant role in this. But it is a challenge, and I realize our plates are full, It is a challenge that that needs to be undertaken. Another area that I know less about, Joe Espo here can tell you more about, Mark Sharmatz, who's sitting next to him, has to do with accessibility to technology in public places. This is another win to be celebrated, although it is on appeal to the Fourth Circuit. I'm confident it's going to stay in the win category. And that's the case against the Redskins. Joe sent me a description this morning so I could accurately. Joe had a microphone. I would just let him talk for himself, but let's see if I can. Here we go. In Feldman versus Professional Football, Inc., the district court ordered the Redskins to make all oral information in the Stadium Bowl, including advertising, play-by-play announcements, ceremonies, referee penalty announcements, and lyrics for music accessible to deaf patrons. And that's now been appealed by the Redskins. They're saying that the case is moot. And they're also saying that we didn't properly require or properly pled the question of requiring captioning of the radio in the concession stands, which I think is the one open issue, which means the case isn't moot. But anyway, another front about which I know less, but is one that continues to need to be worked on. Cell phones. We now have one. We've got the iPhone that is accessible out of the box. Well, there's also the KNFP reader. I shouldn't have excluded that. But we have two that are accessible out of the box without additional cost. We reached an agreement this last year with Motorola that all new phones using their Brew technology that come out after December 31st have to have 12 functions that are 12 listed functions that are accessible. It would have been nice to have an agreement that everything about the phone was accessible, but the current FCC regs draw a distinction between what is the phone and what isn't the phone, so things like the internet are not part of what is the phone in terms of Section 255 application. But we have that. We need more. It is ridiculous that AT&T and other carriers continue to feel free to have a disability tax by charging for the additional software to make a phone accessible when that's such a clear violation of the law. It's not that there's any real problem with bringing an FCC proceeding. It's just that so far the number of hours in the day seem to stubbornly stay at 24, and there are these other matters that we're talking about. And finally, the one other technology area that I wanted to mention has to do with the issue of high-stakes testing. We recently brought a case against the National Conference of Bar Examiners for a law graduate who wanted to use JAWS and Zoom Text for her taking the exam. The National Conference of Bar Examiners had these very reasonable solutions like, well, can't she just move the text under a CCTV back and forth at the rate that she would read on JAWS. Sure. Judge Breyer said he was a little doubtful about proposed accommodations that would clearly make our plaintiff nauseous and trigger migraines. He said there are other reasons why the bar exam does that for people, but it shouldn't be the accommodations. That is up on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. They asked the Ninth Circuit for a stay. The Ninth Circuit said no. She took the exams with the accommodations. We've now said that while the case is not moot, because we had to put up a bond, and who knows which side is entitled to the bond without a trial on the merits, but the appeal is moot because she's taken the exam now with the accommodations, and NCB doesn't think so they're trying to push the appeal to go forward to get a ruling that will do what exactly, I'm not sure, but So it's in this interesting procedural limbo. At the same time, there are going to be three blind law graduates who are going to be taking the Maryland Bar this summer. And so I'll have the unusual experience of litigating close to home, since I suspect these accommodation requests are probably going to be denied, too. In a related matter, I've sort of started at the end, what happens when you get out of law school. If you want to take the LSAT and apply to law schools, the place to apply almost exclusively for most law schools, the only way to apply today is online at the LSAC website. And the application is inaccessible. And we brought that to the LSAC's attention. And they said, well, we can't fix that. And we wrote the 300 law schools. Of course, we did file suit in the interim, but we've sued the LSAC, and then we wrote the 300 law schools and pointed out to them that they have certain obligations under Title II and Title III and that they can't get out of by subcontracting away to the LSAC. A number of those law schools have said we're willing to make our application accessible, and we're willing to send an accessible application form to the LSAC to use. The LSAC has said, well, you can send us an accessible version, a paper version, a PDF version. It's not going to matter. Our software will make the application inaccessible. We can't make law without people like the LSAC, so let's hear it. So anyway, I feel a little bit like I'm saying how I spent my summer vacation up here. So I'm gonna draw this to my remarks to a close, so that there's time to ask Megan and me questions about what's going on. But it's a lot of fun. Anybody wants to join in the dance, just give me a call. Thank you.
Hi, Dan. Matt Dietz.
Go ahead.
Megan, I was wondering if you ever filed a written complaint with the Department of Education, OCR, to see what their formal position is on accessibility.
Yes. Under an arrangement between the Department of Justice and the Department of Education, public universities, for purposes of enforcement, fall within the Office of Civil Rights rather than the Civil Rights Division. So the University of Virginia Darden School of Business had a pilot program also with the Kindle, and we filed a complaint with the Department of Education. We have received to date three pieces of correspondence from the Department of Education. The first one was an acknowledgement of receipt of the complaint. The other two are identical. They're forms. The first question, and there's a yes and no checkbox, is, were you treated courteously with your complaint? The second one says, were your concerns addressed timely? And, you know, and it goes on like that. So I think somebody made reference yesterday to, you know, were the donuts fresh and, you know, was the coffee warm? So that's where we are on that complaint. So I don't know that we're going to put a lot of energy in doing that again.
Other questions? Yes, Lynn. Can't hear you, Luann. I mean, sort of. Try it again.
Can you still? Okay, there we go. First, I need to see Ollie Sprott-Roan and Allison DeFranco immediately following this session. Second, I think everybody here needs to know that we invited no less than four officials from the Obama administration to take part in this session. FCC Chair Jenikowski, FCC Commissioner Copps, Susan Crawford, who we invited twice, once while she was a member of the administration, once after she left, and Mr. Kundra, I can't remember his first name at the moment. None of them could find the time to participate in this session. Now, Dan, knowing the great guy that you are, I know this had nothing to do with you. And you know, I kind of have to wonder what this says about the policymakers. Why are they not taking us seriously? You know, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights could find time to come here. But none of these high federal government policymakers could.
Luann, we also invited Ruslan Ali, I believe, as well.
That's correct. We did. So, you know, what do we need to do to get their attention?
We'll find a way. part of the disability law and rights question is, how do you get people's attention? Often, after you get somebody's attention, they find a way to be interested. Sometimes they don't. The LSAC, we've had their attention, and it hasn't done any good, so we'll have to get somebody else's attention on that one. But we'll get their attention. Other questions? Yes, sir.
We have a microphone over here. We can switch back and forth.
Go ahead. Mike Bullis?
Yes, sir. What about the enforcement of 508 standards for federal government agencies?
You know, I thought my speech was shorter than I meant it to be. thank you, Mike. I had meant to get into that. We're learning 508. I mean, nobody's used it. We have filed complaints against the Social Security Administration for the inaccessibility of its website. We have filed complaint against the Small Business Administration for the inaccessibility of its website. We've filed a complaint against the Department of Education for the inaccessibility of USA Learns. Those are in the process. We got a response from the Social Security Administration saying we didn't procure our website. We maintain and support our website, so 508 doesn't apply. based, unfortunately, on a very bad document issued by the Department of Justice, which misread the statute, which we need to get fixed. But I'm looking forward to taking that one up. SBA has been more constructive in responding to things, but a little timid in terms of their willingness to commit to wholesale corrections. And it has given us the first sign of something I think we're going to see over and over again. To register for 8A or anything else on the SBA website, you are switched to a different URL that's maintained by the GSA that is used for registration as a federal contractor and registration as this and that and the other, and it's totally inaccessible. So the Small Business Administration is saying, who, us? That's GSA. Yes, but it's your 8A program, and to get into the site, you have to register for the 8A program. Yes, but that's, you know, GSA. There's a lot of that going around. I think we're going to see a lot of finger-pointing between agencies where you end up having a runaround. I think the answer's got to be just like the subcontracting away liability in Title II and Title III. You can't do it, albeit that it's another government agency. The Department of Education, I see Allie up there. She can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think we've even gotten something that said, were you treated courteously for your complaint? So we're still waiting to see. We're also in the 508 area getting ready to file, I hope, the first complaint dealing with the procurement of technology. There are some post offices that have point-of-sale machines that are inaccessible. And this is where the real promise, I think, of 508, if we can figure it out, figure out when the procurement is taking place, when is the optimum time to start filing complaints when the government buys BlackBerries, when it buys printer, scanner, faxes that aren't accessible, and other office machinery that aren't accessible. And for those of you here who are in academia, it strikes me that these are easy one-semester or two-semester wonders for clinics. We're happy to supervise, point you in the right direction, proof and file the complaints, but it's administrative. These are administrative complaints. We're doing that with a student at New York Law School who picked it as an independent study project. We're talking to two other law schools that have disability rights clinics, but it's a way to leverage this and make more of it happen. So that's the 508 front.
The post office has the advantage that you can sue them anywhere in the country. Ron?
I'm sorry, Dr. Maurer, I have a mic over here and someone's been hoping for a couple of minutes.
Well, the someone has to say their name. You see, that's the method we do this. Who is it?
It's on.
Who is it?
Bill Phelan.
Okay, Bill.
Thank you. I was wondering if you can talk about the website, the recently released internationally recognized website content accessibility guidelines version 2.0, and whether they're being used to as a standard for whether a website's accessible or not.
Well, I'm not an expert on WCAG, but I think these are much better than the first set of guidelines in terms of they're not being prescriptive to the same degree that the first set were, and more in terms of what constitutes success. One excuse industry uses is to say, well, do we follow 508 or do we follow, 2.0, or what are we supposed to follow for standards? I'm hoping, and I think there will be standard harmonization between WCAG 2.0 and 508. The important thing to remember, though, about the standards is that accessibility is half the story, usability is the other half of the story, and as important and as positive as I think WCAG 2.0 is, we need to keep industry focused on, does the blind person have, or the print disabled person, have access to all of the same information and the capacity to engage in all of the same transactions that the sighted person can with a substantially equivalent ease of use? And that's the goal line by whatever standards. I guess the other thing is, too, that WCAG is cross-disability, which is a very positive thing. But when I'm representing the National Federation of the Blind, I can't arrogate to myself to speak for other disabilities any more than we'd want to see UCP doing a settlement as to what were the conditions for blind people. And the Imperato, hires me. That's a totally different story. But WCAG is cross-disability. And because a lot of people have questioned why we don't use the WCAG in our settlement agreements. And part of that is that we don't think we should speak for anybody except ourselves.
Questions?
Gardner?
Yes, sir.
Dan, speaking for myself, I like the fact that you're representing us. Keep doing it.
Thank you.
I feel like I have had sort of a muzzle on me for the last couple of years, that and the muzzle has been removed. I currently serve on the United States Access Board. As many of you know, the U.S. Access Board has been working on 508 refresh, and that version of the refresh, those regulations, have now been released. Public comment is invited and encouraged up to June 21st. Now, there's some good news and bad news. The bad news is that this is only an advanced notice of public rulemaking. In other words, we're going to go out until June 21st, and then we're going to take it back to the Access Board and look at the comments we got and then come back out. So that's the good news. It's important that we take the time, if we want to affect this new version, this new refresh of regulations under Section 508, now is the time, until June 21st. So go to, I think it's register.gov or federalregister.gov, go to access-board.gov, go wherever you want to, but look at the refresh of Section 508. Now, the refresh applies to three different laws. It applies to Section 508 of the Rehab Act. It also applies to Section 255 of the Federal Communications Act.
Right.
And it applies in very limited respect to the Americans with Disabilities Act. That only applies to point-of-sale machines and kiosks. So all of us who are frustrated at the airport and, you know, different places where we have to buy tickets and get self-service at kiosks, these refresh proposals apply to kiosks and point-of-sale machines under the ADA. I will say that the proposed regulations do use the WCAG 2.0, so that's the answer. I know that because I've seen it. There are some things that I'm very familiar with personally. I know that we need to use the word non-visual access, and I'm doing my best to get those words put into this document, non-visual access. That's important to us. There are others that say, oh, no, we don't need it to say that. We need to say something else. Well, I think the current version has non-visual access. If you like those words, write in and say that those words are important. There are some other things dealing with the the harmonization and universality. But, Dan, I'm happy to say also that this refresh document is dealing with usability and functionability.
Mm-hmm.
So please spend the time. If it's important to us, it's important enough to us to pay attention to. So I'm asking for us to please go look at those refresh proposals under Section 508, et cetera, and make your comments known by June 21. Thank you very much.
Let me underline that and say that the
Can I
say one
more thing, Dan? Sure. and this is brief. We had a public hearing at CSUN in San Diego. Okay, that one's done. But there will be another public hearing, an opportunity to come and make public comment. I believe it's May 12 in Washington, D.C., and I think I'm scheduled to conduct that hearing. So mm-hmm. I ought to find out when it is. But I believe it's May 12 in Washington, D.C., so you can go to the website and find that out. But if there's one in your area, please go and make your comments there as well.
I just wanted to add that if you're not a technical person, don't think, oh, well, I don't want to take the time to read the 508 refresh. One of the really smart and good things about this new version of 508 is it's really written in terms of outcomes. It's not written in terms of label alt tags and use headings and skip navigation links, the stuff that Ian Taylor knows so well. It's written in extraordinarily clear English. It does have some holes in it, but I do recommend it for you can put it by your bedside and it won't put you to sleep. Read it.
This is Eve Hill. I was just going to thank you, Dan and Megan, for letting me work with you on some of these issues. It's been fantastic, but it seems like every time we touch something, there are 5,000 other things that have come up around it, and the tech accessibility issues are everywhere. We've got to start looking at them in everything that comes out. So things I've just recently learned, the HHS issued a request for comments on health IT, which is all supposed to go electronic, and it did not mention disability. And so we all have to be responding to those things all the time. There was the Comcast decision the other day, which limited the FCC's jurisdiction, which leaves us a much greater need to focus on getting Section 255 applied to internet technologies. People with disabilities have the lowest access to broadband of any group. And the broadband access plan includes disability, but the grants that have been going out to sign people up to broadband are really aimed at how many people can you hook up at the least expensive cost. And our people are more expensive to get to and to get hooked up and to get the AT features and accessibility and usability features that they'll need to actually make use of the broadband. So we have to be going to FCC and educating about those things. And then there are just so many of these things going around, I think I missed some of them. So I'm kind of disappointed that the Consortium of Citizens with Disabilities disbanded its tech task force, which used to be a sort of clearinghouse for getting access to these things. I just think we have to be watching this just everywhere it comes up. And I just discovered that DOJ put out an RFP for telephones. And rather than making all the telephones have accessibility features such as an audible signal for when you have a voicemail and so forth, they would require that 10 out of every 5,000 have accessibility features. This is getting so far away from universal design, you can't believe it.
Sounds like a 508 complaint.
It does, doesn't it? And yet DOJ is the group that's supposed to be monitoring all the agency's 508 compliance. And where was the last report on that? 2003, I think? So we're not even being able to keep up with what they think they're doing, and they haven't incorporated it into the standard contract requests that go out into the world.
We have time for another question.
Sir, Tara Tripathi from Orlando, Florida.
Yes, sir.
It's a very laymanly question, but what troubles me and a lot of us is that when I buy a Windows computer, a PC, I mean, the cheapest I could find on buy.com was $150. But in order to use it, I would have to buy something which is seven times more expensive than that. Now that the Apple has shown the way, we have the Apple iPhones, iTouch, and iPad and everything, which is accessible out of the box. Is it on the cards? Maybe it's too soon for that, but maybe it's on. Is it on the card to work with Windows or maybe sue them to make their computers accessible out of the box?
First of all, under the ADA, we can't get to manufacturers of technology, so we wouldn't be able to sue Microsoft. The second thing, and Anne or someone else could probably here address this better than I could. VoiceOver has been on Apple for a long time, and I think it's fair to say that in recent times, VoiceOver has proven to be fairly useful for blind users who like Macs. But having said that, there's been, I think it has been seen as desirable that there were AT manufacturers whose market was the blind community and the dyslexic community and had to be responsive to the concerns of those communities in a way that an Apple or Microsoft is never going to be in terms of when they come out with new releases and what those new releases were going to be about. So, yes, the cost was more, but I think the advantage was that the community could pretty clearly say to Freedom Scientific or whoever, here's what we want next. Now there are open source free screen reader softwares to be had. How robust they are, I don't know. Ann would have to answer that, but...
Who are you?
Allison DeFranco, I'm sorry.
Allison, go ahead. You're the last one, though.
Can you hear me? Okay. Yeah, no, sorry. Sorry to jump out there, but I just did get a new Windows 7 computer, and although I still prefer my Zoom text in my Kurzweil and put them on, I didn't do that for a week because it was the first that's it's accessible out of the box. I don't know if anyone else has had that experience, but XP and Vista were not. But now they have moved forward with that, where there's both the full screen reading as well as there's the Zoom capability.
Dana and Megan, I want to thank you both. I would say this about the two of you and your firm and your colleagues and who are sometimes in your firm and sometimes out, that Dan has worked on this for two decades plus is valuable because he knows this area. Few lawyers in America know this area. There are more now who are interested in it than there used to be, but this was such a small unknown area that a substantial knowledge of it was a piece of valuable intellectual property. And we were delighted that Dan went to the trouble of getting it and has encouraged other people to know it. I think that it is hard to overstate the value of having a substantial law firm that has this as a major portion of its work, because it means that there is a repository of knowledge that doesn't disappear after this case. So I appreciate your working on it, and I appreciate your commitment to it. I also appreciate the fact that you and your buddies have guts. It takes that. That's why I am delighted that you were able to come to this, and I look forward to the next 25 years.
To spread that body of knowledge, there are applications for the Disability Rights Bar Association membership right up here. Sorry.
Yeah, I put some money into that thing, you know. Charlie says it needs more money? Anyway, you guys can get your applications up here, and let's see if we can't get this idea that accessibility is true. Megan said that we're in a race, and it's true. We have to get a piece of this big enough that we get to critical mass before the critical mass gets away from us. Very important. We have some workshops. Pros and cons of class action lawsuits. This will be facilitated by Steve Schwartz, Executive Director, Center for Public Representation. The threat to self and other defense. The facilitator here is Christopher Kaczynski, Assistant Legal Counsel and Director of ADA Policy, Division of Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Litigation of disability rights cases in the United States Supreme Court. This will be facilitated by Claudia Center, Senior Staff Attorney, the Legal Aid Society Employment Law Center. And the fourth one is Lessons Learned from Litigating Olmstead Cases. The facilitator is Jennifer Mathis, Deputy Legal Director, Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law. We have a break for just a few minutes, and then we get to these workshops, and I'll see you back here at 11:15.